Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, January 7th. Let's start with the front page. From the Decatur City Council, solar project charges ahead. Tony Reed, Decatur. City okays solar farm zoning as neighbors voice concerns. One of the latest projects in a heated nationwide rush to build new solar farms, got the green light from the Decatur City Council. Operating under the name of a specially created company called Decatur Northwest One LLC, based in Houston, Texas, the farm will cover 27 acres on two parcels of privately owned land, totaling almost 46 acres in the 4,000 block of Northwest Lawn Avenue and the corner with West Mound Road. The site is close by the Macon County Fairground. The combined 7-megawatt project will soak up energy from the sun and turn it into enough electricity to power more than 1,200 homes. Cost of the project hasn't been revealed, but background information circulated at Monday's council meeting says construction is scheduled to start in 2027 and will take about 6 months. The farm's operating life is estimated at 35 years. Solar farm developers across the nation are hot under the collar to get these projects moving. President Donald Trump, no fan of renewable energy, effectively ended many green power tax incentives years earlier than planned with the passage of his One Big Beautiful Bill in July of 25. Macon County has subsequently seen the recent approval of several major solar power developments, including one near the Oakley Sediment Basin and another in Maroa and Friends Creek townships. City Council members, with a series of unanimous votes, allowed the Decatur Northwest project to go ahead by agreeing to change the zoning of the land involved from single-family residence to intense commercial light industrial to legally accommodate the development. Councilman David Horn was an enthusiastic backer. He believes that clean energy access for local residents and a healthy surge in property tax income for the city that will be generated by the new Decatur solar farm offer a win-win for local taxpayers. So from all of those perspectives, I think this is an important project for the city, Horn added. Before Monday's council meeting, the City Plan Commission had voted earlier, 8-1, to recommend approval of the zoning changes, but had noted strong opposition from one resident who had shown up to an earlier public hearing on the issue. That resident, Joshua Dobeld, described as a concerned neighbor, said a better use for the land would be affordable housing to be built at this time, not in 35 years after decommissioning of the solar farm. Dobeld said the land involved was better suited for homes. And there were more unhappy voices who spoke at the council meeting during time allowed for public comments. Decatur resident Diane Spaniel looked north to Maroa, where a windstorm trashed a solar farm there, and cleanup of the mess has been a long time coming. Is that going to happen in Decatur? She asked. Both Lacey Elzey, the city's economic and community development director, and Marua Jabouri, the solar farm project manager who spoke at the council meeting, said that was not the case. Monday's agreement the council voted on included strict provisions paid for with bond money that would fund cleanup at the site if disaster strikes, and rules in place will see the site returned to its previous condition when the sun sets on the solar project. The bond will cover the full cost of decommissioning, said Elzey. Jabouri said it's in her company's best interest to make sure the facility is well maintained and working well. If the project is damaged and not properly fixed right away, we're not generating electricity, we're not getting any revenue, she said, so this is just kind of the big picture. Council members were also told the solar farm would be site-screened by evergreen trees and shrubs, and one interesting feature is the green approach the solar farm management is considering on the issue of grass and vegetation trimming sheep. The idea is a small herd will wander amid the solar panels behind a fence and keep everything trimmed the natural way. From Peter Hancock at Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. Report, health data left exposed for 3 years. Human Services Office reviews website privacy settings after breach. The Illinois Department of Human Services disclosed recently that it mistakenly uploaded private health-related information about hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans to a publicly accessible website and left it there for more than 3 years before it discovered the mistake. But the agency would not explain this week why it took officials so long to discover the problem, or why officials waited more than 3 months after it was discovered to notify the individuals affected and the news media as required by federal rules. In a news release dated Friday, January 2nd, IDHS said the data breach involved two categories of individuals. One category included approximately 32,401 customers of its Division of Rehabilitation Services, which provides services to people with disabilities. The other involved more than 672,000 recipients in the Medicaid and Medicare Savings Program, which helps low-income Medicare beneficiaries pay for premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance. In both cases, the agency said, information about individuals was uploaded to a mapping website used by the agency's Bureau of Planning and Evaluation. The Bureau used that site to create maps to assist IDHS with resource allocation decisions, such as determining where to open new local offices, according to the news release. It said the maps were intended for internal use only. However, according to the news release, due to incorrect privacy settings, the maps and the information contained within them were publicly viewable. The maps containing information about rehabilitation services customers were publicly accessible from April 21 through September 25, when the flaw was discovered, the agency said. That included customers' names, addresses, case numbers, case status, referral source information, region and office information, and individual status as DRS recipients. The maps containing information about Medicare Savings Programs recipients were publicly accessible from January 22 until September 25. The information included addresses, case numbers, demographic information, and the names of individuals' medical assistance plans such as Medicaid and Medicare. The information did not include recipients' names. In both cases, IDHS said the vulnerabilities were discovered on September 22, 2025, at which point officials changed the privacy settings to restrict access to only authorized IDHS employees. The agency said it also conducted a comprehensive review to determine the type of data contained in each map and assess its reporting obligations under state and federal law. IDHS has developed and implemented a secure map policy that prohibits the uploading of any customer-level data to public mapping websites, the agency said in its January 2nd news release. Under this policy, no identifiable customer information may be uploaded, entered, won, or stored on public mapping platforms. Access to any customer-related maps is now restricted to authorized personnel based on role-specific needs. According to federal regulations under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, whenever a health plan, health care clearinghouse, or health care provider discovers an individual's protected health information has been breached, that entity is required to notify the individual without unreasonable delay and in no case later than 60 calendar days after discovery of a breach. When a breach involves more than 500 residents of a state or jurisdiction, the entities are also required to notify prominent media outlets serving that area within 60 calendar days after discovering. The news release announcing the two breaches at IDHS was issued 102 days after the agency said it discovered the breaches. IDHS declined to answer directly when asked by Capital News Illinois why it took the agency more than 3 years to realize it was exposing individuals' protected health information on a public website, and why, after discovering the vulnerability, it took the agency more than 100 days to provide the legally required public notification. The privacy and security of IDHS customers and residents is an utmost priority, the agency said in an email. Immediately upon learning of the issue, IDHS moved to secure the relevant information and began internal review and practices to prevent anything similar from happening in the future. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. Now from Brendan Moore, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. State politics. Graduated income tax a long shot. When a progressive Chicago alderperson scolded Governor J.B. Pritzker in November over his opposition to Mayor Brandon Johnson's failed proposal to tax large corporations $21 per employee, Illinois' billionaire chief executive was quick with a retort defending his progressive bona fides. What we need is a progressive income tax, a graduated income tax in this state, Pritzker told Chicago Alderman Byron Siegcho Lopez, a Democratic socialist who confronted him following a Veterans Day commemoration in Little Village. You know that I've worked very hard to get that passed. Pritzker poured $58 million into the 2020 campaign advocating for a change in the state constitution to allow for an income tax structure that would charge higher rates for higher levels of income. For nearly six decades, Illinois had a flat income tax that charges one rate each for individuals and corporations regardless of income level. But Illinois voters ultimately rejected the proposal to change it, leaving the tax rate at 4.95 for individuals. It only received 46% support, far below the threshold needed to change the state constitution. In the years since the flameout, Pritzker and Democrats who control the state legislature have mostly shied away from the cause, all while managing to balance the books under the existing tax structure, largely thanks to a strong economy and federal aid in the years after the pandemic. There are signs, however, that the state's chronic fiscal challenges are reemerging and likely to be exacerbated by federal policy changes enacted by the Trump administration. Despite this, it appears the graduated income tax will also be off the table as a remedy, at least in 2026. Pritzker, who put the fair tax at the center of his 2018 gubernatorial campaign and served as its chief champion during the failed 2020 referendum campaign, told reporters in November that putting the question on the ballot is not something that's been a priority for me going into the next session. I think it's something that is being talked about by members of the General Assembly. We'll have to see if it gets proposed, Pritzker said, reiterating his belief that a graduated system is better than a flat tax system. Pritzker is running for re-election in 2026 and is widely viewed as a potential Democratic candidate for president in 2028. While Pritzker isn't putting it at the top of his agenda, some Democrats in the legislature would like to again place a graduated income tax question before the voters. State Senator Rob Martwick, Democrat, Chicago, introduced legislation in both 23 and 25. The first was a lone wolf effort that did not get called before the 24 election. But Martwick has 17 co-sponsors on his current resolution, and similar legislation in the House filed by State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, Democrat, Bridgeview, has more than two dozen co-sponsors. The deadline for lawmakers to pass a resolution to place an amendment on the 26th ballot is May 3rd. I feel like there is this huge appetite for some sort of restructuring of our tax system to make it less regressive and to provide relief to middle and working class people, Martwick told Capital News Illinois. Republicans and the state's business community have long opposed the idea. The 2020 initiative was in part torpedoed by a relentless $60 million ad campaign that was mostly funded by billionaire Ken Griffin, the state's wealthiest resident at the time. From a policy perspective, a graduated income tax structure is one of the easiest ways to rectify the state's chronic structural budget deficit while simultaneously shifting the tax burden to its wealthiest residents, advocates say. Those points have been reinforced this year amid fallout from President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which granted significant tax relief to the country's top earners while slashing social spending that states like Illinois have relied upon to balance their budgets. According to the governor's budget office, the state is facing a $2.2 billion budget deficit next fiscal year, a number that could grow to more than $5 billion by 2031. The numbers are based on current law, meaning they assume no new spending or tax increases. Changes enacted in Trump's signature law, such as a requirement that states spend more on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and reductions to Medicaid, could exacerbate the state's fiscal issues. When the graduated tax amendment failed in 20, Pritzker lashed out at Republicans in the business community, declaring state tax policy at a crossroads and warning there will be cuts and they will be painful. But with boosts from federal stimulus funds and increased tax receipts spurred by post-pandemic economic activity, Pritzker and state lawmakers have been able to enact balanced budgets in all but one of his 7 years in office, with COVID impacted 20, the outlier. And the state has paid off a backlog of bills that had ballooned to more than $16 billion during the height of a state budget impasse a decade ago. But that boon is over. The past 2 years, lawmakers had to enact a series of tax hikes and other revenue enhancements to keep the budget balanced. The party's over, Ralph Martyr, the executive director of the Center of Budget and Tax Accountability, told Capital News Illinois. And the party's over because Illinois' long-term structural problems in their fiscal policy have never been resolved, so the state's tax policy doesn't work in a modern economy. Martyr's organization has long advocated for restructuring the state's tax policy, including broadening the sales tax base to include services like haircuts and lawn care. It has also advocated for a graduated income tax structure. He argues it is a simple path. The state needs to capture revenue in growth areas, and in the decades since Illinois enacted an income tax, income has increased, most among the state's wealthiest residents. That's the textbook way, Martyr said. The ideal thing to do would be to amend the Constitution to permit a graduated rate structure. And what you also don't want to do, because there's been some advocates of this, is put that rate structure in your Constitution. Another proposed amendment being floated by former Democratic Governor Pat Quinn would place a 3% surcharge on income over $1 million. The tax would raise an estimated $4.5 billion and be set aside for property tax relief. Quinn's effort comes after 61% of Illinois voters signaled support for the idea when asked in an advisory referendum question on the 2024 ballot. "We have an upside-down tax code right now," Quinn told reporters in November. "We give all kinds of tax breaks to millionaires, and we have higher property tax bills for everyday people, and that's not the way to go if you want to have a fair society that emphasizes home ownership and affordability and also emphasizes the proper way to fund education." Quinn's populist approach to policymaking has not always been warmly received by state lawmakers, but he insisted that his idea can pass as it's a little easier to understand the millionaire amendment than the question that was put on the ballot in 20. Like the graduated plans already proposed, Quinn's plan would have to receive 3/5 support in the legislature to get on the 26th ballot. State Representative Natalie Manley, Democrat Joliet, filed legislative language for a millionaire's tax last year. Her proposal, which does not have any co-sponsors, differs slightly from Quinn's, as revenue raised would be split evenly between property tax relief and education funding. Lawmakers could also take an approach that wouldn't require a constitutional amendment. This would involve raising the flat income tax rate while also upping refundable tax credits for low and middle income taxpayers. Illinois currently has an earned income tax credit available for people earning up to about $67,000. The state also offers a child tax credit to those who qualify for the state EITC who have at least one dependent child. Such credits have been found to stand up to state constitutional muster. Martwick said that would be an acceptable plan B, but thinks we should always try for the best policy first. "And I think that would be a constitutional amendment that provides a really good, well-thought-out, structured plan that allows everyone to contribute and have skin in the game, but in a way that allows everyone to thrive and isn't overburdening one segment over another," Martwick said. Illinois' first income tax was enacted in 1969. It was championed by Republican Governor Richard Ogilvie as a way to plug a budget deficit, reduce reliance on sales and local property taxes, and to increase funding for education. Ogilvie originally proposed a flat 3% to be charged across the board, but state lawmakers eventually settled on 2.5% for individuals and 4% for corporations, a compromise forged with Chicago Mayor Richard Daley in exchange for Democratic votes. The flat rates were necessary to comply with the uniformity clause of the state's constitution. When a convention was held in 1970 to create a new constitution, the tax was so new that delegates' focus was enshrining it into the new document, not messing with the rate structure. As such, delegates adopted language permitting one rate for individuals and one for corporations. The individual rate hovered between a 2.5 and 3% until 2011, when state lawmakers enacted what was billed as a temporary increase to 5% to help fill a budget deficit and pay down overdue bills. The rate reverted to 3.75 in 2015, but it was permanently raised to 4.95 in 2017, when legislative Democrats and a handful of Republicans overrode a veto from then-Governor Bruce Rauner to end a more than two-year state budget impasse. The state's corporate tax was temporarily raised from 4.8% to 7% in 2011. It went back down to 5.25% in 2015 before being permanently raised to 7% in 2017. Businesses also pay a 2.5% personal property replacement tax, which makes the effective rate 9.5%. From Tony Reed in Decatur, City Weighing Nonprofit Scoring System. The City of Decatur is mulling over introducing a scoring system to check whether your nonprofit organization is worthy enough to be given a grant of taxpayer money. But the proposed system, called the City Council Community Grants Evaluation Criteria, wound up getting a pretty low grade itself when it was trotted out for consideration at Monday night's City Council meeting. The idea, as explained by Interim City Manager Melissa Hahn, is to codify how charities and other not-for-profit organizations doing good works and seeking council support will be judged on whether they get financial help. And with only $70,000 set aside for the grant program for the 26th financial year, competition is likely to be intense. Hahn said applicants will need to present a good case. Due to an increase in requests for funding from various organizations in the community, the City Council desires to establish an open and equitable process to allocate funding, the manager outlined in a briefing memo to the Council. City staff have drawn up a scoring sheet with six categories and a maximum score in each of 5 points. Areas to be judged range from how a grant application advances the City's goals, such as economic growth, safety, revitalization, or quality of life, to how an application addresses a demonstrated need with measurable benefits for residents or businesses. Hahn said city staff will do the initial check of applications and then pass them on to council members for review and scoring. Councilwoman Lisa Gregory didn't hold back in giving her initial score. She rated the whole enterprise a fat zero. She pointed out the city just went through a tough budgeting exercise as it tried to hold the line on expenses while faced with an uncertain economic future. And so we have to remember that these $70,000 are from our taxpayers, and I just don't believe that we should be taking those dollars in a year when we don't know what the financial future holds and using them for grants. Mayor Julie Moore Wolf had her doubts as well. She said she was supportive of giving it a try this year, but wasn't so convinced this deserved to be an annual feature on the council's expenditure list, regardless of how it scores and grades grant applicants. I don't know if this should be an annual deal, she added. I'm not sure that this is the best time to be giving out additional money. Councilman Pat McDaniel said, "You have to be careful what you start once money is handed over, however worthy the cause. Once you start a program, the public wants it to continue," he cautioned. Councilman David Horn was prepared to be more generous in giving the score-related grant system a chance. He said the scoring criteria valued initiatives like neighborhood revitalization, a major city council priority, and he noted many Decatur organizations, from feeding programs for the homeless to domestic violence shelters, were running into financial difficulties. "And if we can help, we should help," he added. The city manager said she would follow up with council members individually and bring a revised grant scoring proposal back for consideration at a future meeting. From our food page today, we have lemongrass chicken strips from Jean Marie Brownson. Better for you fare still offers plenty of indulgence. Lighten up. We also have a recipe for winter bean salad with lemon vinaigrette that serves six, and a red chili yogurt dip to serve with blanched vegetables or to use as a spread on turkey roll-ups. And now from our opinion page, Movieland Merger, from Ev Ehrlich Ehrlich was Under Secretary of Commerce under President Bill Clinton. He wrote this for Inside Sources. Ehrlich's column is entitled, Bigger Can Be Better If Netflix Wins Warner. The contest between Netflix and Paramount for Warner Brothers has storylines and personalities that would make gossip mongers from Luella Parsons to Maria Menounos gape. Gulf State plutocrats providing financing without board seats or any other governance rights, according to the Los Angeles Times. Presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner championing Paramount's efforts, then walking away, according to NBC. Larry Ellison, the billionaire co-founder of Oracle, pushing to personally guarantee $40 billion to backstop his son and Nepo financier David Ellison, according to the New York Times. President Donald Trump insisting he will have a great deal to say about how the dice will come up. That's plenty for the rumor mill to digest. Yet all that pales compared to what the two bids say about the future of American entertainment. Paramount says it wants to save American movie making. Netflix, it argues, would scale back production and gut the cultural ritual of theatrical release. That defies common sense. Netflix wants Warner because it brings new programming for its cutting-edge distribution network. Would it really cut back on the most important thing it's buying? And Netflix's top execs readily acknowledge that theatrical releases build interest that boosts their performance on streaming, leaving viewers to count the days until a new Knives Out reaches their tablets. Warner has super premium products such as James Bond, Harry Potter, and Gandalf the Wizard in the mix, so it's no surprise the company has pledged to stick with Warner's theaters-first approach. Paramount's bid guarantees production cuts. Acquiring Warner Brothers would saddle the company with two historic L.A. production lots to be combined, almost certainly by shuttering one to generate the $6 billion in savings Paramount promises from the deal. Production also likely would fall victim to Paramount's massive post-deal debt, which it projects to be many times its annual earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, a level usually associated with junk financing. Netflix's debts, in contrast, would be far less than Paramount's when compared to earnings by 2027. Does Paramount have the creative chops to keep Warner Brothers a content powerhouse? Warner Brothers has had $3 billion releases since 2017, Aquaman, Joker, and Barbie, and a near miss in a Minecraft movie. Paramount had just one, Top Gun, Maverick, the final fruit of an IP stream its creator will no longer sustain. Since 2017, Warner has won 19 Oscars and Netflix has 26, while Paramount has one. So what superior creative insights would Paramount bring to Warner when compared to Netflix? Beyond these measurements, Paramount wants to acquire Warner Brothers so it can be today's Netflix. But Netflix wants to acquire Warner Brothers so it can create something beyond today's Netflix. For movie fans, creative industry workers, and policymakers, what's a more intriguing deal? Paramount's private equity quest for efficiencies and scale, or Netflix's entrepreneurial mission to find new ways to tell historic stories across multiple screens, platforms, and markets? Paramount's effort to win through scale ignores the commanding presence of entertainment industry behemoths such as YouTube, Disney, and even its potential sibling, TikTok. YouTube dominates global viewing share, capturing almost 13% of audience attention, far outstripping Netflix at 8%. Netflix can take pride in its steady growth to 300 million subscriptions, but that's a sneeze to YouTube with nearly 3 billion active users. Artificial intelligence will turn content creation into a spiraling free-for-all. Netflix offers support for the film industry and its workers, a new future for Warner Brothers, and a competitive champion in the streaming wars. That's a path forward that consumers, workers, investors, and regulators should be ready to support. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, January 7th. Please stay tuned.